Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 25th day of August. My God, the summer went fast. I don't know.
It's not over yet, Joe.
I know.
Please.
I know. It isn't. I know that. But it sort of is. But it's. I say this because today was a day that a lot of. Are you all back? You're back in college.
Returning upperclass students are not yet back.
Okay.
But our first year students have been with us for about 3 weeks.
I know many of the local colleges are in session today. Or tomorrow. And so I noticed a little bit of the influx of traffic this morning. And that, I think that's more faculty than it is students, but still. So for them, summer is still, yes. So logistically, summer is still here, but, you know, it's pretty much done. We have Labor Day weekend next week. And we are thrilled that you are with us on this Monday morning on the 25th. At 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. Let me introduce the group to you. We'll get started. We welcome the voice I was just speaking to, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
How are you?
Great.
Oh, good. Now, Malia has such strength at Bard. She brought everyone else from Bard with her today. Uh-huh. We have quite a contingent. Senior fellow at the Center for Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff joins us. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Joe. Hope you're doing well.
I am, and thank you very much for being here. And senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer joins us. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Happy to be here as part of the Bard Troika.
And to keep them in line, we welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning. Don't forget, I'm also an adjunct at Rockefeller, so I have some academic credentials, but not really.
That's actually pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Malia, can't you give her a position at Bard on the
actually,
spot?
Actually, so like Rockefeller University in the city?
No, like Rockefeller College for Public Affairs
and
Policy.
Oh, I got it.
At
right.
my alma
then
mater.
Then you'd be in a Bard affiliate if it were the other Rockefeller.
Oh, okay.
So, oh, wow.
But you still can be a Bard affiliate.
You can still
Libby.
Offer me a job if you'd like.
Yes.
It's not too late.
The deals that happen on this
show
are just amazing, I'll tell you.
Yeah,
how
just wait for the break.
Yeah. Right. Bring it all out and contracts will be signed. It'll be very exciting.
Battlefield promotion.
Right, and then you'll have a new job, Joe. So
yeah. I want to get started here. We have a lot to talk about. It was a busy weekend, and there's things to talk about. But let me just bring up the fact that this program will be on the road. We have this effort called WAMC on the Road, and that necessitates us to go on the road. So we're going to do exactly that on September 8th. We are going to be in Lake Placid, New York, a place I've been to many, many, many times in my life, but not recently. I have not been to Lake Placid in a while, so I'm very much looking forward to being back there. Monday, September 8th at 9 a.m. I'm just going to double check that because I thought it was weirdly on a... Hold on. One
no, second. I think it is because I'm looking at Sarah's email.
Yeah, Monday. That's right. Monday, September 8th at 9 a.m., 9 to 12. And so here's the thing. This is the way this is going to work, and it's something we've never done before. So we're going to try it and see what happens. But from 9 to 10, the show that you hear at WAMC listeners will hear, 9 to 10 will be our show, and we'll have a very special program. And then from 10 to noon, we are going to simulcast this program with our friends at North Country Public Radio. So, in other words, no matter where you are in the North Country, you can't get away from us. You can try, but it's going to be hard. So we're going to be, the show will be aired on their network of radio stations. It'll be aired on our network of radio stations. And the incomparable Emily Russell and Kara Chapman, two great reporters and North Country Public Radio personalities, will be joining me as we dig into the demographic and livelihood challenges facing the Adirondacks and Adirondackers. We'll be talking in our first hour. We'll be talking about trade. We'll be talking about Canada. We'll be talking about what that means for Canada, what it means for the Adirondack Park, what it means for the North Country. Also, then, in our 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about the demographics of the Adirondacks and going from an aging population to a workforce struggling to find affordable housing. And, of course, we'll be welcoming questions from a live audience. If you would like to be a part of that live audience, all you have to do is go to one of our websites, WAMC.org or NCPR.org, NCPR.org. There's a very slight registration fee, but otherwise you can get a ticket. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org. And if you look at WAMC on the road, it'll bring you right to where you need to be at the High Peaks Resort, 9 to noon on the 8th of September. So we look forward to that, and we look forward to having you all with us on that very special day. Let's see. Let's start off, and now that I've introduced everybody, we'll start off and get to the news of the day. I want to talk about the National Guard. I want to talk about the National Guard in Washington, D.C., and I want to talk about the expansion of that over the last 2 weeks or so, and how that's going over. Well, and then at least as far as reaction from it, and then we want to talk about how the president has now decided that it would be a good idea to facilitate this in other places. In the country, and the two that seem to be at the top of the list are both Baltimore and the city of Chicago, and it's it wasn't lost on me. I don't think it's probably lost on anybody, but the president has had a thing for Chicago for a really long time, and when I say a thing, he just seems to be annoyed and has always talked about the. Do you have a theory on this, Libby?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. But always talks about the crime and how bad Chicago is, and it's an unlivable city and so forth. So the fact that that a National Guard presence would potentially be going to Chicago, I don't find overly surprising, given the setup of what happened in D.C. But then also, we also have the possibility of Baltimore as well, and other cities, including New York. We should note the Big Apple. Libby, do you want to posit your theory?
Yes, of course. So, who is it that lives in Chicago that got a Nobel Peace Prize, that dropped the mic on Trump at a Washington correspondence dinner during his presidency? I wonder who that could be. I think his last name begins with an O and ends with an A. That's what this is about for Chicago. And the fact that it is a Democratic town, it's a Democratic state. You know, you've got Pritzker as the governor, who's a very smart guy, and a potential presidential contender. And I think it's about that. Now, you go to Baltimore, that's because there's a black mayor in Baltimore, and we know that the blacks can't, you know, keep themselves out of trouble, is what Trump is thinking. And so the great white savior and the National Guard, some of whom are going to be black, are going to come into Baltimore and clean it up, just like they're going to try in other Democratic states. Wes Moore, the governor of Maryland, said thanks but no thanks. Everybody is saying the same thing. Whether he can actually get away with all of this remains to be seen. Now that the National Guard is carrying weapons in Washington, D.C., let's see how many Kent State-like situations we end up with.
Mr. Trump said on Friday he was considering using the same playbook in other American cities and that Chicago could be next. The administration has not indicated when the National Guard could be sent to Chicago, New York, or any of the other cities the president has mentioned. Rahm Emanuel, remember him? The former mayor of Chicago and in the Obama administration, said on CNN on Sunday that Mr. Trump's threat was more a reflection of the president's animus toward Chicago's Democratic leadership and desire to crack down on immigration than a considered strategy to take on crime. When you look at what he did in D.C., he's not going to actually deal with crime, Mr. Emanuel said. This is an attempt to deal with cities that are welcoming cities, known as sanctuary cities, and deal with immigration. Violent crime in Chicago, Washington, and other major cities has fallen in recent years. Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois said in a statement on Saturday, there is no emergency that warrants the president of the United States federalizing the Illinois National Guard or sending in federal agents. The governor said he had not received any communication from the White House about such a deployment and added that the president was, quote, attempting to manufacture a crisis. Mr. Trump said on Friday that New York City would be the next target for a federal policing effort after Chicago. So if you're keeping track of this, this would
Democrat,
be
Democrat.
D.C., Chicago, New York City. Jim Getter.
Well, first thing I would say is I certainly agree with Libby that it's just a matter of time until there's some kind of accident. There's already been an accident between a military vehicle and a civilian's vehicle. But I think the more and more in which you have people with weapons patrolling around and people who are not trained to be police officers, something is likely to happen. I think the also, what happens if there are protests in one of these places? Then what will be the actions of these armed troops? What will be the orders that will go to these armed troops? And will there be a point at which somebody, mid-level or higher, says, you know, I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. I need to not follow this order, or I need to do something other than what is happening. So far, Libby, you said, you know, we'll see if the president can get away with doing this. He's getting away with everything.
Yeah.
So I've lived in places where it's common to have military, armed military all over the place. And it has a chilling effect. It is designed to have a chilling effect. It not only has a chilling effect on the citizens of the country, but it also has a chilling effect on the military itself. It sends the message from the leadership, so these are the other places I'm talking about, that says, I own you. You know, you are there to do the bidding of what I want you to do. You are there to do the bidding of the regime. And particularly with National Guard troops are going to then go back to their lives, that this, you multiply this across multiple cities and many, many, many National Guard troops who are doing this, this is going to have long-term consequences on the institution of our military, on the people who serve in it, as well as all of the, I think, the really negative things that are likely to unravel over time.
Do you think any of this, I go back and forth on this, and I don't know, maybe it doesn't even matter, but is it planned in the sense of we start off by saying there's troops going into D.C., National Guard troops going into D.C., step one. Step two, we're going to double the number of troops going into Washington, D.C. Step three, we're going to clean up the homeless population. We're going to move them out. Step four, we're now those agents are going to carry weapons. And there's this escalation. We're going to do more. 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 Is that planned? Or is that just that it's not getting the desired effect initially so that it always has to seem like it's more and it's more and it's more? And then once you've reached sort of the apex, you say to yourself, okay, well, now let's go to another city and rinse, repeat.
Yeah, I don't know how I don't know how much of it is planned or how much of it is just kind of, you know, pushing on a unlocked door, and it the more it opens, the further you can go with these sorts of things. It has this escalatory effect. I mean, D.C. is a special case because it's a federal district, and so the laws and regulations that guide what's happening there are very tricky. I mean, even when you have federal troops, you know, arresting somebody for an open container violation, which is a local issue, you send them to federal court or not. But D.C. is an outlier case. But you start getting into these other cities, and you start sending National Guard troops from other parts of the country into those cities, which is what's happening in D.C. These troops are coming from – they're mobilized from other states. You're really off to the races for some I just think some, you know, all kinds of unanticipated consequences.
Yeah, it's interesting. I understand that one state volunteering National Guard troops is Tennessee, and the highest crime metropolis in the United States is Memphis. Mm-hmm. So you know, they don't need to go far if they want to make a difference on the streets. I would be quite surprised to learn, you know, from an exclusive news report that there's a long-term plan here, Joe. I'd be very, very surprised to learn there's a plan. Long-term planning doesn't seem to be the hallmark of this administration, at least not yet, on any subject. I think that, you know, that this started as an effort to dominate the news cycle, something that President Trump is very, very adept at, to change the subject from Epstein, from Ukraine,
exactly,
whatever,
it.
Dominate the news cycle. I must say, I lived and worked in the D.C. area for about 35 years before moving up here. Crime is a problem. I don't care what the statistics say. And if Democrats are going to put themselves in the position of saying, oh, you know, statistically, crime is down in these cities, that's exactly where President Trump wants them to be in terms of their own argumentation. And I have to say, if I were an African-American dad living in certain neighborhoods of the District of Columbia, I would want to see all kinds of law enforcement presence. I don't care if it's the National Guard, FBI agents pressed into doing street patrols, an expanded police presence. If I were an African American guy with kids in those kinds of neighborhoods, I would want to see some very, very active policing. This does not appear to be part of the program so far. We've seen pictures of National Guard's people strolling along the D.C. Mall. We've seen reports of immigrants being rounded up. But where is the actual assault on crime? In the neighborhoods that suffer the most from high crime. Maybe that's coming. Maybe there's a plan to address that. Who knows? But I'm just not seeing it yet.
Wait, can I just jump in for a second and say, I totally agree with you, Fred. And, you know, National Guard troops from Tennessee or South Carolina and the multiple places they're coming from, they're not trained to enforce crime issues in Southeast Washington. You know, there is indeed a problem. I live there, too. And there's indeed a problem, as there are in many of our cities. But is this the way to address it? I would say certainly not.
I do want to make a point of every time we talk about this, because I do think that there is this constant conflation of crime and the crime in the streets and what the president refers to as hideous crime. And then in the same breath, talking about the unhoused and homelessness. And those are two very, very different issues that are being shoved together. And what I'm finding fascinating is in Chicago, disturbingly fascinating, in Chicago, is that there are plans of $40 million in new services to deal with the problem of the homeless in Chicago. And meanwhile, the president is calling for some 76,000 people to be housed in basically which are long-term, what he refers to as long-term institutional settings. That is being done as a part of this effort to talk about quote-unquote crime.
In those long-term institutional settings, there's not going to be any federal funding for them. And they're going to make the states pay for it all, and there's not going to be any funding there either. So, okay, then they'll just become the problem of the state. I mean, not that it's a problem, but, you know, he is doing all of this. Fred, you got it right. All of this is to divert attention to the big shiny object over there, which is Jeffrey Epstein. You know, this notion that Ghislaine Maxwell said she never saw Trump do anything inappropriate or anything like that. I mean, she's being, I think, people are putting words in her mouth because who knows how real any of this is. And they're just trying to keep everybody's focus on all this other stuff instead of the criminality that's actually going on in the White House.
Malia.
So much to talk about here. Well, I got an idea. If you want to make a difference with the homeless problem in this country, then stop cutting support to veterans. Because guess what? A lot of veterans are homeless. Like a high proportion of homeless people in this country are veterans. And one person who was caught up in the law enforcement efforts in D.C. was a veteran, a former airman who was accused of assault because he threw a sandwich at some troops. And he was, you know, angry at them and, you know, expressing his irritation at the situation.
Charged with a felony.
Yeah, for throwing a sandwich.
Right. It's very soft bread.
But it was a sub. I mean, let's be honest.
Okay.
He threw a sub at him.
Yeah.
Well, so as someone, you guys, Joe, were kind enough to have my mother on the program earlier this this summer, and she retired from Kent State University. You know,
we want her back, by the way. Who's her agent? We want her back. We want her back on the
I think
show.
She's probably listening right now, so she tends to listen when I want. She loved it. But, you know, I grew up, and she spent the biggest chunk of her career at this institution that has become synonymous with the problems that this kind of approach leads to. As Jim said, National Guard, they are not law enforcement. They are not trained to be law enforcement. There's a whole office in the Pentagon called Defense Support of Civil Authorities, where I used to work. And that's what they're meant to do, support civil authorities in responding to emergencies, or if there's some kind of, well, all kind of emergencies, natural or human-made. And so it's inevitable that there will be some kind of deadly mistake. That's what happens in a combat zone, which is essentially what the president seems to want to turn D.C. into, is some kind of combat zone.
That's what makes him feel strong.
I'm concerned for these troops. A lot of people join the military specifically because they want money for college. That's a benefit they get from it. So these are young people, and I'm willing to bet that many of them are they're going to have to defer their fall semester or whatever. I mean, it's not seasoned by and large. It's not people with many years of experience who are out there in the streets. The majority of them are going to be the lower enlisted troops who have less training than others, because that's where the numbers are.
And those who are quote-unquote lucky enough to be in shelters, and there are so few beds available for anyone, much less veterans, but there are specific shelters that are out there for veterans. But the problems that they face as far as both medical care as well as dealing with the food pantry system is
at the nexus. You talk about intersectionality. Like, veterans are at the nexus of a lot of negative trends in this country, that they experience homelessness at higher rates than other populations, that they need the kind of support from food pantries and from the VA, which is being cut from every direction, including their workers having their bargaining rights removed. It's really terrible for people who have volunteered to put themselves in harm's way for this country.
So what happens, group, when we expand this, when we put it to the next step of we have it in one large metropolitan United States city? I was born there.
I hope we have some lawyers listening, because it's as I think Jim said. I mean, D.C. is a special case because it's a federal city.
Correct.
Right. How I honestly don't know, even having worked on some of these issues in the Pentagon, whether the president can just decide, oh, I'm going to federalize these troops and force them to serve in these various cities that aren't the same as Washington, D.C. I mean, I don't know. I assume there's some kind of, I hope there's some kind of higher legal barrier to that happening. But I don't know for sure. It's a very specialized area of law.
And I can imagine a scenario that a few months ago would have sounded completely insane to talk about. But here we are in New York City, Donald Trump's hometown, where one way or another, whether it's legal or not, the troops are sent there. And it really becomes much more political than having to do with crime. And it will have everything to do with the election of Zohran Mamdani as mayor. And the troops will be there maybe to deal with crime, maybe to deal with homelessness and immigration issues, but really to, quote unquote, save New York City from socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's so many problems with that. But I can see a scenario like that playing out where that's really the nature of the troop presence in the city, in the five boroughs of New York City, having to do. And what does that mean? Is Mamdani allowed to take office? Is he not? I mean, there's a lot of ways you could see this playing out. And again, you know, I always go back to other places I've lived that have these kinds of troop presences, and it's always ultimately a political act.
You talk about other places you've lived. One of the things that I'm trying to figure out, which I find just interesting, and I know it's probably my own hunt here to find information about, but Philadelphia has yet to make the list. And it's not that it won't, but it has yet to make the list. It has an African-American female governor, a Democrat.
Mayor, excuse me.
Democratic governor.
Jewish Democratic governor.
Jewish Democratic governor. And we have a story on the docket today we may or may not get to about the transit problems and the real issues that they're dealing with in the city of Philadelphia, fiscally speaking, as well. And I just wonder, so is the simplest explanation for that because Pennsylvania is a swing state? Is it as simple as that, or are there other, like, I know we're talking about how there's no rhyme or reason to this, but I keep on looking for some rhyme or some reason.
Yeah, and you may end up being very frustrated with that. there does not seem
to
be.
Just go do Wordle.
No, there's no clearly spelled out methodology behind any of this. It is almost entirely unpredictable. If 6 weeks from now the President of the United States has a crying need to change the subject from X to Y, then we could see National Guard. And I agree, Malia. I'm not sure what the legal basis is of all this. D.C. is a special category. But if the president has a crying need to change the subject, that may be the entire rationale for federalizing the Illinois Guard and deploying units to downtown Chicago. It may be no more than that. I suspect it will be no more than that.
But one clear pattern is these are all places with Democratic leadership.
Right.
Fred said
that's what this
Memphis
is, about.
Is a big
Memphis.
That's
true of almost
high crime.
Most of the big cities in America.
Yeah, but there's other places with a lot of crime. I mean, right in Mike Johnson's district, Shreveport, Louisiana,
yes,
is off the charts in terms of violent crime. Doesn't this seem likely to send troops there.
This is just about characterizing any democratically controlled state or city as crime-ridden. That's all this is in order to continue the bleed that the Democrats are seeing, right, from voter enrollment, which is very unfortunate, but also just to continue his trope that Democrats are bad, I'm the savior, and that's the end of the conversation.
And yeah, there's that layer to it, but there's also other potential layers downward, I would say, of use of force for political control, to just be blunt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And can I just point out that there's actually, so the governors who have been sending troops to D.C., I mean, who might give troops to other efforts as well, it's not just a political incentive. There's actually a serious financial incentive for them to do that, because when their National Guard is federalized, those troops get access to federal retirement benefits. And so it lessens the amount of money that the state has to put towards these troops. It's actually extremely expensive. And that's a lot of the work that I did when I was in the Pentagon, you know, working on these issues. It's trying to figure out, I mean, and there's been an effort by governors for, you know, over a decade now to expand the influence of the National Guard, because it brings a lot of money to their states. And that's why it didn't used to be the case that the head of the National Guard Bureau, the chief of the National Guard, was on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But now that person is. That happened a couple years ago. And so the influence of the National Guard as a political entity has been rising for years. And this is one of the outcomes we see.
And Malia, if I could just pick up on one point you made earlier, because I think as a, you know, as a former Army officer, this is an important point. A lot of these guardsmen are very, very young men and women, enlisted troops. In any deployment of this nature, involving interaction with civilians, it's absolutely necessary for these young troops not to be left alone. It's absolutely necessary for officers and NCOs to be present.
Some adults in the room.
Adults. There have to be
adults in the room.
Yeah.
Right.
Novel concept.
We'll take a break. Last night I was getting sort of down reading about all this, and I decided that I was going to change. And I thought, oh, what section may there be? Because sometimes you read like a health story, and you're like, oh, this will make me feel they're going to eradicate this, or they're going to do that, and I know those stories are rarer these days, but and then I found myself suddenly just sullen, sitting in my chair reading about the screw worm. Have you read about the screw
yeah,
worm?
I did.
Good God! We have our first travel associated case in a human. It's usually in animals, and now it's a disgusting, horrible parasite. That is being found in a human. It was found in a human, I believe, in Maryland, and so.
What is it?
It's disgusting. What they talk about, the reason it's called the screw worm is because it's like this little parasite, and then it goes in, and then it like the little maggot things come.
Did they find it in RFK Jr.'s brain?
No.
Is that the one?
No, because those died. These are all alive.
Oh.
That's the difference. And then they bore in and then they
okay. And this was
sucked the life
this
out.
Was found in Maryland?
I believe so.
Another blue state outrage.
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
The first human screw worm case. Okay. I intentionally did not put that story on the docket, but I did want to mention
you.
It because if you want to
yes.
just be sickened, read about the screw worm. We'll take a break. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, very nice to have you with us. We are talking about National Guard troops going into our nation's cities. The president has talked about the quote-unquote success of the troops being in the city of Washington, D.C., and further plans to go into Chicago. next, and after that, Baltimore, at least, those seem to be the plans that were hinted at over the weekend. We've been discussing that. We have letters from listeners, and I'll go to those now. Jay writes, the roundtable is taking a reasonable stand on the situation. However, there is the opposite side as well. My son just returned from Europe, where folks were telling him how they don't want to travel there because of all the violence. In D.C., crime was lessening, but still high. As of last week, it went way down. The long-term plan should include all kinds of social help. That is from Jay, who makes an interesting point about how perception, of course, comes into all of this.
I would say, you know, I used to run a program for the State Department called Education USA, and I was dealing with students who were hoping to apply to colleges in the U.S. and their parents. And the number one question that people often had in Egypt was, is it safe in the U.S.?
Because I ran across that in China as well.
Yeah, and that perception is definitely out there.
Which just impacts the bottom line. I mean,
when
tourism is so important to this country, and we're seeing it, you know, Elise Stefanik's going to have a lot to answer for, because we're seeing it in the North Country with Canadians not coming over that much. But tourism plays a very big part in our economy.
And higher ed, too.
Right. And if students. We keep saying everything's dangerous, it's going to undermine the economics of the country.
Christopher writes, I disagree with the theory that deployment of National Guard troops to cities is a distraction. I don't think that gives enough credit to Trump and his cronies. Could it be that this is being done in order to test how easily they could impose martial law when they suspend elections? I'm truly frightened at the thought. That comes after a similar letter from Gloria, who says the National Guard does get us used to seeing troops in our streets. Then we go to Jim, who writes to us and says, you were trying to find a rationale for irrational, capricious, and spiteful behavior and actions. Yes.
Yeah, we are.
We are beyond that stage and need to work out how to defeat it at the next election. That from Jim. We go to Deborah, who writes to us. Since you are not a black dad or black person, please step aside and let a black dad speak on the subject of policing in black neighborhoods. Historically, we have many reasons to be suspicious of policing of any sort and thus seek to avoid them. And that from Deborah, a black mom. We go to CP, who says, the three highest crime cities are Memphis, Detroit, and St. Louis, all Republican governors, and there are no Trump takeovers there.
There won't be.
And then we go to Matt. I just passed through Union Station and walked past the Supreme Court with WAMC in my ears, naturally. Aside from the congressional complex, which has retained some sovereignty with Capitol Police, all the major intersections along the route and inside the station itself have clusters of National Guard MPs now armed with pistols doing, nothing. At best, this is waste. I overheard more than one disparaging remark thrown their way and have seen plenty of shaking heads, some among the troops. As I hit send, I am passing through the intersection where the MRAP vehicle hit a local resident's car. The only reason Ford and the convoy to have been there is that it would have been on the way to or from the National Guard Armory on the far east end of Capitol Hill. So an on-the-ground moment of the moment.
Crime problem is not in Union Station or in front of the Supreme Court. But I'll tell you what isn't a real, I think, reason behind this, if there is some reason, is that if someone were to show up and protest in Washington, they're going to be protesting in these kinds of places. And as I said before, the continued and increasing presence of troops like this is undoubtedly going to have a chilling effect. There are going to be people who are going to think twice about exercising their constitutional right to freedom of expression and protest and assembly when you have phalanxes of armed troops. All along the way, you get off the train in Union Station and you walk over to the Supreme Court. It's a short walk, and the whole way you're seeing troops and military vehicles and all of this. It's bound to have an effect.
Yeah, and I think over the years, at least, you know, at least since D.C. Became a semi-home rule area in 1973, the Washington, D.C. Police Department has done a pretty good job in developing a solid program of community policing. One of our letter writers made the very accurate point that black communities around this country have had, at best, mixed experiences with police. But I don't think one has to be black to be able to see that African American parents in certain parts of D.C. would welcome an enhanced police presence in their neighborhoods, night and day, as they try to protect their children. And I think to the extent to which the federal government is willing to offer additional assistance, so that the D.C. Police Department can expand its ranks, I think that would be welcome. Again, I'm not seeing any evidence that that's the approach.
I'll just it's great to get that letter from Matt on the ground. I think that was the name of the letter.
Yes.
I'll just make one correction to what Matt said, which is that not all these troops are military police, and that's part of the problem. Military police get very specific, extremely specialized training, but even they are not trained for law enforcement in the broader community. That's not their role. Their role is to be the police force for the military itself. And if they are actually military police, they get a special armband that says MP on it, and I'm pretty sure that's not who you're seeing in the streets of D.C. They're pulling together the National Guard troops who are available, who say, oh, yeah, I've got a couple weeks to go on duty because they're going to earn more money, more retirement benefits from this. And I bet it's a wide mix of specialties who are now patrolling the streets in D.C.
Rachel writes to us and says, I think many people recognize that many of the things that the Trump administration is doing are immoral and likely illegal. What surprises me is not that they are doing the things. They are a collection of the worst of humanity. What upsets me is I'm not sure how patriots who believe in democracy win. Even if the Democrats prevail in the midterms, the winners will not be seated. So what now? That from Rachel, rather chilling letter, but certainly something to keep in mind. Andrew writes to us and says, two possibly very unpopular and certainly not politically correct questions on bigger picture issues. One, when are we, media, politicians, citizens, going to realize that Trump isn't the problem, but instead the symptom of a complete lack of adequate education of the American public? Two,
correct.
When are we going to realize the ultra-conservatives who have turned Trump into their useful idiot have been playing such a long game that liberals and centrists will no longer have a chance to regain control of legislatures, governorships, and possibly the presidency anymore?
He's right. The writer is correct. The folks like the Heritage Foundation, the Republican Party, the right, have been working on this from the 1970s, taking over school boards, taking over library boards, taking over town boards, and working their way all the way up to the presidency so that, and then we all argue with each other over stuff that we can't have an impact on, really. The international stuff. Yeah, could we protest the Vietnam War and stop it? Yes, we did, but it took a really, 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 really long time. Can the Democrats who are fighting each other over what's going on in the Middle East really have an impact on it? No, I'm sorry to say, we really can't. And so all we're looking like is that we're arguing with each other over stuff that we cannot really have a major impact on, taking up all of our time and ignoring organizing on the local level, ignoring organizing on the state level and on the federal level. And, you know, we have to stop arguing with ourselves. I can tell you the one thing the Republicans don't do is they don't argue with themselves. They take orders from the top. And we're seeing that being played out right now. We have to stop arguing with ourselves over issues that we cannot have a real impact on and really focus on what's important, which are the local, state, and national elections. And we have to start locally. You know, that it's just that simple.
Almost has me want to go back and read about the screw worm.
Yeah, right. I mean, the thing is this, you know, right. Well, there's always that. But, you know, I've said this before. In the 1990s, Bill Bradley, the basketball player
yeah. Yeah.
who was a U.S. senator, wrote this great piece in the New York Times. And I read it every so often, and it's, like, all true. He just laid it all out, how they were working to do this for a very, very long time. And we were asleep at the wheel. On a number of levels. I mean, we won in 2008 because Obama was exciting to people and he brought people together, you know. And we won in 2020 because of the disgust to Trump. But that disgust did not last very long because he got reelected. And look what's happening now. You know, you've got Jeffrey Miller saying, oh, all the old hippies should go home and go to sleep.
Stephen Miller.
Right. All the old hippies go home and go to sleep. They don't count anymore. Well, we'll see. But we also can't afford to just argue with one another.
Well, the things that President Trump is doing are supported by upwards of 50% of the electorate in this country. I think we need to ask ourselves, why is that? And what can be done about it?
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other subjects, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 6 minutes past 10 o'clock on this 25th day of August. Our panel made up today of Malia Dumont, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Ambassador Fred Hoff is here, Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College. Jim Ketter, also Senior Fellow at Bard College Center for Civic Engagement and Political Consultant and Lobbyist Libby Post. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are going to move on to other subjects. I do want to read one letter that I got from Mary Lou, and she said, okay, Joe, I heard your story last week about meeting Kelly, who's my wife, my dear wife, about meeting Kelly at the Washington County Fair. It's such a nice story. And, of course, I understand why you visit that fair every day. The fair is a special place for you. That's correct. That's true. But, Mary Lou chides me, you drive right through Scaticoke every single day on your way to and from work. By the way, I don't know how she knows that. But,
well,
I mean, she's not wrong, but still.
Isn't that the
other way? There are other ways.
There are?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, anyway. She's right, but still. Have you ever stopped to our county fair? I don't recall you ever talking about the great Scaticoke Fair. I'm offering you a twofold chance to make up for that neglect. Well,
yeah,
first,
what is this anyway?
Yeah, first of all fairs are created equal. If you have your county fair in your county, God love you. Please go and go to all the county fairs in your region. They are wonderful, wonderful operations that need to be supported. As far as the Great Scaticoke Fair, I do. I go by the Scaticoke Fair every night. I love the Scaticoke Fair. I've been there many, many times with my wife and my family. I believe I have mentioned the fair on the station over the years. And the reason I haven't mentioned it recently is because it's not open yet. It opens officially Wednesday.
Details.
Yeah, it'll be open Wednesday. Because wouldn't it be creepy if I just started talking about being at the fair and it wasn't open? But it would. They open on Wednesday, and they'll be open through Labor Day. And it's a great fair. Rensselaer County, a wonderful. A lot of my farmer friends who live on in Easton and Stillwater and in the confines of just outside of Washington County all show their animals at the Scaticoke Fair.
I have a little nachas. Nachas in Yiddish means being proud, right?
Okay, yes.
So Alex, our son, is an organic farmer. He runs Over Creek Farms in Wapentake Falls. And at the Dutchess County Fair, they got best in show for their squash.
Wow.
Yes, they did.
You were
actually
there?
Yes.
Fred?
Took two of my grandsons to the Dutchess County Fair on Friday. And I got to say, that is a spectacular fair.
Yes.
They do a wonderful job there.
That's what we've been told.
So Mary Lou has invited us, my wife and I, to the fair.
Good.
And wants us to come out, and we'll do that. I'm very excited to check things out. So don't worry, we'll be there. I appreciate it. I'm certainly not. I will admit, even yesterday, Kelly and I were like, do you want to go to the fair? And we're like, I'm a little fared out. Like, I'm just.
We went
5 days in a row, and I was just like, kind of fared out.
I was on a video shoot with a client a couple of weeks ago, and we went to the Lewis County Fair and the Watertown, or the Jefferson County Fairs. And it was really something. It's like I got really good footage of the cows so that I can make them into talking cows for my client, which is what I like to do.
All right. Well, somebody's got useful
work
around
here.
We're
all alive and well.
There's all kinds of things. Hey, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do to win a vote. That's all I have to say.
Could be a whole new WAMC on the road.
Yeah,
the,
right.
The county fairs listening area.
I got to tell you, Jim, at the risk of elongating this conversation, I was sitting in the I was sitting at the 4-H booth at the Washington County Fair, and I looked across, and there's a new sort of seating area there. And I looked at it, and I thought to myself, "That'd be a great place to broadcast from."
See?
It's just got like we get seating, they've got the internet connection right there. I thought, man, I got to look into this. We got to bring this thing on the road. We'll bring it right to the fair. That'd be awesome.
Yeah,
and close to my house. I wouldn't even have to go by the Scaticoke Fair that day.
Okay, then there you go.
There you go.
All right. Let's go to other important issues, certainly more important than what we're discussing now, and we'll talk about what is happening. I do want to talk about the big news that dominated all week last week was about Ukraine and Russia. And now a statement by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov deals a blow to President Trump's efforts to mediate an end to the war in Ukraine. As the top diplomat says, there is no plan for a Putin-Zelensky meeting. A top Russian official told NBC News that there was no meeting planned between the leaders, dealing a blow to Trump's efforts to mediate an end to the war between the two countries. The foreign minister said on Meet the Press that there needs to be an agenda first before a meeting can take place. This agenda is not ready at all. The comments came about a week after Mr. Trump hailed his summit in Alaska with President Vladimir Putin of Russia as a groundbreaking success. After the meeting, Mr. Trump suggested that Mr. Putin and President Zelensky of Ukraine had agreed to meet and that he was making preparations for this encounter. But the interview with Mr. Lavrov appeared to be the Kremlin's most direct declaration yet that a summit the White House suggested was imminent was nowhere close to materializing. In a subsequent interview on NBC, Vice President J.D. Vance pushed back against the notion that the Russians were stringing Mr. Trump along with their refusal to set a meeting with Mr. Zelensky. Mr. Vance said the Russians had already, quote, made significant concessions, including recognizing that Ukraine would have territorial integrity after the war, that they would not be able to install, quote, a puppet regime in Kyiv, and that there would be a security guarantee for Ukraine. Of course, they haven't been completely there yet, or the war would be over, Mr. Vance said. But we're engaging in this diplomatic process in good faith.
Yeah, but it also said that Russia would have some role to play in their security. And it's like having the fox guard the hen house. I mean, let's be honest. And this is all about, again, going back to what we talked about the first time, why is Trump putting all this, you know, his focus is on Chicago now? It's because Obama won the Peace Prize. Trump thinks he needs to win the Peace Prize to be as good of a president or to trump, you know, Obama. And so, of course, he's upset because he can't end the war in the Middle East. He can't end the war in Ukraine. And he just it's going to drive him nuts between now and the end of his term.
Yeah, and in terms of the vice president's statement, I'm not seeing any evidence that that there are any kinds of objectives-based negotiations going on that would have produced any kind of substantive concession from Russia at this point. What we see is a series of statements. We see a strong reliance on personal meetings, but we're not seeing a strategy. If it's there, it's well concealed. I would also
or it doesn't exist.
I would also note that there's an exclusive in my favorite newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, today, about how the Trump administration has imposed on the Ukrainians a restriction on the use of U.S. Army missiles in the Ukrainian inventory, a restriction on using those missiles on Russian territory, where the previous administration, they were allowed to do it, to hit airfields and so forth. So on the one hand, the president is blaming his predecessor, President Biden, basically for allowing the Ukrainians only to defend, not to take any offensive action, and yet it is the Secretary Hegseth, Pentagon, that has imposed this restriction on the Ukrainians. You know, at the end of the day, you know, the result I personally would like to see is Russia defeated. But I think the president, our president, places a lot of reliance on a personal relationship with Vladimir Putin. And Vladimir Putin, being a professional, takes full advantage of that.
Well, Vladimir Putin just has his hand up Trump's back and you know, playing puppet. That's it.
I just want to follow up on something Fred was saying as well, and rightly so, and that is the, you know, what Ukraine can do now militarily. And, you know, people tend to think, and I think oftentimes in a hopeful way, and they say, like, well, can't we go down the path of diplomacy and to see that as completely disconnected from what's happening militarily? And they're not disconnected. No. They're never disconnected. And Vladimir Putin knows that very well. The number of attacks, the tempo of it, the lethality of them have really stepped up because he's anticipating that there will be some settlement at some point, and he's trying to make sure that the Russians are in as strong a military position as possible. And, you know, I was critical of the Biden administration during those days because, as I recall, Fred, I think the basic deal with Ukraine being allowed to strike outside of their territory was kind of on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and they had to be military targets, targeting civilians.
And not everything was approved.
Right.
And there were a few times when the Ukrainians didn't ask. They sought forgiveness rather than permission.
Yes.
And there were lots and lots of problems. This was during the Biden time. And so I think that was a mistake. I think that the Ukrainians, who I said from the very beginning, I mean, I've spent some time in Ukraine, that, you know, this was a people who were fighting for their lives, and they were fighting against an invading force into their sovereign territory. That also, I think we need to keep in mind what has been going on. We've seen the specific targeting over and over and over again, including up till now, of civilian targets within Ukraine. Mm-hmm. We have seen the kidnapping of thousands of Ukrainian children who have been spirited away and brought into Russia. Even, I think, Melania Trump wrote a letter about this to Vladimir Putin. And it's a serious violation of international law. We have seen the systematic use of rape as a weapon of war across Russian-held territory. We have seen Vladimir Putin indicted for war crimes that have been happening here. So we should not just sort of see this as like, well, you know, they have some grievances, there's some issues, and, you know, the nature of this invasion, the nature of what's been going on, and that it's been stepped up, it hasn't been stepped back. I think we, the United States, whether it's through Biden or, you know, before Trump now, we should allow the Ukrainians to defend themselves fully. And, you know, in terms of security guarantees, there's a very good reason that the Ukrainians are pressing on this hard. Because guess what? In 1994, we gave them some version of a security guarantee.
For giving up the nukes.
Right. They had inherited nuclear weapons, the end of the Cold War. Everybody, for a variety of reasons, thought it would be best, including the Ukrainians at the time, to get those nukes out of there, how to do it. And the Ukrainians wisely said, well, we will do this, but we need security guarantees to make sure that our territorial integrity is solid and that we are protected. And so a document called the Budapest Memorandum was signed by the Ukrainians, by the Russians, by the Americans, by the British. And in 2014, when I was there in Ukraine, the Russians took back, depending on your version of history, Crimea, and they were unofficially invading the Donbas, the southeast part of Ukraine, with what was then called Little Green Men. And there was serious fighting going on. I went to several funerals of people from northwestern Ukraine who had been fighting in the Donetsk airport and things. And so what did we do in response to that? What did the United States do? And after we had already signed this memorandum, nothing. I mean, I think maybe a few sanctions here and there just for PR purposes.
This was the Obama administration.
This was the Obama administration. Yeah. And the message was loud and clear to Ukrainians and to others who I was working with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, other NATO delegations, who would say to me over dinner and drinks and say, you know, do you really think the United States will live up to Article 5? Will they protect the Baltic states? Will they protect these other small states? It sure doesn't seem so. So you can imagine, you know, we might not know that here in the United States, but you can bet that Ukrainians remember that history.
William.
I think the word efforts that was used in that article that you read from earlier, Joe, is an exaggeration. The Trump administration hasn't made serious efforts to bring peace to Ukraine. It's wishful thinking that he can sort of crown himself some international peacemaker. But Trump has no leverage with Putin.
He's got no cards.
He's got no cards. He wants things from Putin. And Putin can just wave his hand. It has no effect. So It shouldn't be surprising to anyone who just looks and does basic analysis of who stands to gain or lose from this that nothing came out of that meeting in Alaska other than Trump sort of parroting the Putin talking points, that Russia hasn't changed its position at all because it didn't need to. There's no incentive for the Russians to agree to what Trump says or was saying that he wants. So it's a sad commentary. It's a sad continuation of this sort of abandonment of Ukraine that started as Jim said when the United States didn't live up to what it had agreed to do with the Budapest Declaration.
Putin has absolutely no reason to capitulate at all to Trump. He holds all the cards here, and Trump doesn't realize it, because he's not that smart. And the thing is that, I mean, somebody said this before in one of the letters, but we're not teaching our own people to be analytical about foreign affairs. We're not teaching civics. We're not teaching people how government works anymore. I mean, and so, and remember, Trump said in 2016 as he hugged the flag, "I love the uneducated," and boy, have they delivered for him.
And I just want to clarify, because I'm sure we'll get some letters coming in saying, how can you say that we've abandoned Ukraine when we've spent and sent billions of dollars worth of weapons to them? Well, that's not the same thing as standing up
right
with them. It's helpful to a certain extent, but it doesn't mean that Ukraine has been materially strengthened to the point that it can withstand this ongoing Russian assault without additional help.
Yeah, and I think it's a fair game to detail the shortcomings of both the Obama and Biden administrations in dealing with this crisis. But one thing that neither President Obama nor Biden had a problem with was identifying who the aggressor was.
Right.
Yeah.
So where do we go from here, do you think, I mean, it's as simple as that question of where do we go from here? And assuming that the president of the United States is still going to use this as a way to tap people on the shoulder and remind them that he has cards, even though he may not.
Well, you know, this is another case of the late great Yogi Berra emerging as the master of wisdom in all of this. When he said that predicting is difficult, especially about the future. predicting how President Trump will handle this crisis in the future. Should rest on an assumption that there are some basic principles he is adhering to, that he has a national security objective in mind with regard to Ukraine, that he has a strategy aimed at achieving that national security objective. I don't think those things exist. I think from point to point, depending on developments, the president will first assess what can I do, what can I say to make me look good under the circumstances. If I'm right about that, then Joe, I'm afraid, you know, you can ask the question, where do we go from here? It's the problem is there's no answer.
I think it's almost impossible to predict what might happen in Washington. But I can tell you what I think that many of the European leaders are assuming will be the shape of a future settlement. And one is that as unpleasant as it is, that for many, that Crimea will stay Russian. Two, that there would be that Russia would not be guaranteed to keep all of the territory that they have won in this invasion. But within that, there would in this Donbas area in the southeast of Ukraine, there would be kind of an international protectorate. Where you do have a lot of ethnic Russians, that doesn't necessarily mean they're pro-Putin, but you have an area that is contested in some way, and maybe the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is one of the only international organizations where the United States, the Europeans, and the Russians are all members, and they do have a part of that organization that deals with military monitoring, border monitoring, something. I think you'd have something there. There'd have to be an ironclad security guarantee. And in terms of NATO membership, I think you have to kick that can down the road. I think in a lot of European capitals, that's the shape that they're seeing and aiming toward. And Washington, I have no idea.
And with respect to Europe, I think what you're saying is very important, Jim. And I would commend to everybody a brilliant article of a few days ago by the noted conservative columnist George Will in the Washington Post, in which George Will pointed out that twice in the 20th century, the United States came to the rescue of Europe. And now it's the turn of Europe to come to the rescue of the United States and try to hold the United States as part of the West.
And that's what happened when we saw all these European leaders show up when Zelensky came to D.C. to meet with Trump. Mm-hmm. That was an extraordinary group of people who came over to D.C. Because I think they genuinely were concerned that Trump might say or do something that would put the entire NATO alliance in jeopardy. And so that didn't happen that day because that many presidents of different countries showed up. You can't get those people to show up every week and look over Trump's shoulder and sort of prop him up and you know, encourage him to do from their perspective what the right thing is. And so I just that's one of my concerns.
We will come back with. Oh, we have concerns about so many things. We'll share those right after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday. It's the 25th of August, 34 minutes past 10 o'clock. And hello, and how are you? I hope all is well. We go to other topics and check in with our group on some things that have happened over the weekend that I want to get to. Of course, you know, we talk about a lot of issues, and to me, one that is often buried and in the onslaught of news and is forgotten, and I think we should be talking about damn near every day, and that is the famine in Gaza and what is happening in Gaza and what that means. There is a story in the New York Times this morning that global monitors confirm famine in part of Gaza, and then asking that question of what does that mean. We've discussed this at some length on this program in the past, but UN-backed food security experts determined on Friday that Gaza City and the surrounding areas are officially suffering from famine. Israel has blocked most food and other aid from entering the enclave since the war began nearly 2 years ago. The determination of famine came from the Integrated Food Security Phase classification, known as IPC, a group of international organizations that the United Nations and aid agencies rely on to monitor and classify global hunger crises. Israel's coordinator of government activities into the territories, an agency responsible for managing the entry of aid into Gaza, rejected the IPC's finding. The IPC report is based on partial and unreliable sources, many of them affiliated with Hamas, and blatantly ignores the facts and the extensive humanitarian efforts led by the State of Israel and its international partners, according to the head of the agency. The IPC said at least 500,000 people in Gaza, which includes Gaza City and nearby areas, were facing starvation, acute malnutrition, and death. It said the rest of Gaza's population, which numbers 2 million in total, was also struggling with severe hunger, and that famine could spread to other parts of Gaza by the end of September.
I'll get things rolling. I mean, it strikes me, first of all, the debate over whether or not famine, in quotation marks, is occurring in Gaza is about as meaningful as the debate over whether genocide is taking place in Gaza. In this part of the world, since October 2023, in response to the atrocities of Hamas, what's happened in Gaza has been unspeakable. People want to call it genocide or something, it is an abomination. It is absolutely unacceptable. It needs to stop. hunger has been ubiquitous for nearly 2 years. There's no doubt about that. You know, there are 2.2 million people, 60,000 of whom have been killed. This just goes on and on and on. The president of the United States, in my view, and I could be wrong about this, but in my view, he has the power. He can pick up the telephone. He can, in essence, order the prime minister of Israel to cease combat operations. He can bring pressure to bear on Hamas to release all of the hostages, living and dead. For this to go on and on and on, this unspeakable suffering, the traumatization of an entire generation of children, this ought to be acceptable. And again, where are the adults here? Where are they on either side of the equation? Where are they in the United States? What's stopping us from bringing the curtain down on this once and for all?
Good point.
I recall that the first roundtable after the October 2023 attacks, I was here in the studio with Fred and Libby. And one of the things that we talked about was, of course, Israel needs to respond. But if the response is not only strong but smart,
yep,
that eventually that this was going to lead to something akin to the situation that Israel got itself in Lebanon after the 1982 invasion, and that it was eventually mired in a quagmire, and that we now see in Israel many of the same kind of responses that happened after a failed presence in Lebanon in the 80s. We see, you know, increasing international criticism of Israel, to put it mildly. We see increasing protests within Israel against these policies. We see increasing tensions over who serves in the military. And the law has been changed in Israel about the ultra-Orthodox and
they're
drafting.
Not happy.
And it is, no. I mean, to talk about tensions, I mean, the flare-ups are intense. And these also are tensions that are playing out within the Israeli cabinet. We also see a failure to achieve political and military goals, failure to even really articulate, I think, fully what those goals are. And as Fred said, and this shouldn't be last on my list, a deep, deep suffering and tragedy of the Palestinian people as well. And so all of this then leads to, like, well, you know, so where to go from here? And as Fred said, the United States still has great agency in this. And the White House, the Oval Office, could have a great effect on ameliorating this, and that's not happening.
And it's not going to happen, because Trump's not going to do anything to challenge what Netanyahu's doing. He'll give lip service, but he's not going to make him do anything. All this is doing is creating more opportunity for homegrown terrorism. It's making Jews across the world less safe, because people can't make the distinction. Let's be honest about that.
Right.
The majority of people cannot make a distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, and we see that when Jewish businesses are defaced all over the country, and now there's up in New Hampshire, I think, there's a movement for a whites-only community, and they made it really clear, no Jews, because we're not really white. You know, so, I mean, this is not who we are, and I've said this before. This is not who we are as a people. It just isn't. This isn't what I was taught, what it meant to be Jewish, is to make people suffer. We went through suffering. We know what suffering is. We lost 6 million people during World War II, right? And you know, my dad fought in the war. And so it's like, come on. If you want there to be peace, let these people eat. Let these people live. Let these people have a life. and so that they see Israel as compassionate and the Jewish world as compassionate, which is what we're supposed to be, and not as a pariah. It's sort of like, you know, I've been reading this stuff now that the notion of empathy is antithetical to Christianity, and that for the far right, and they don't want to be empathetic anymore, and this is the same sort of stuff. And it's not like the people in Israel themselves want this to continue, because people are on the streets.
Right.
You know, they're in the streets. They know that this is not the right way to go. And Netanyahu's government is splintering because the Hasidic refuse to serve. They don't want to serve in the army. And I'm like, well, you know, you live there. You've been living off the dole for a really long time. It's time to do something. But they won't serve. And so everything's going to blow up. And it's not going to be pretty, and children are going to starve, and they already are starving, and that's what's so disgusting about all of this.
And Libby, I agree with what you're saying. My only reservation is I wouldn't rule out entirely the possibility that President Trump could bring down the hammer on all of this. The problem is it's not predictable. Because the president's actions, the president's thoughts on all of this do not seem to be rooted in any particular principle, in any particular view of what the national security interests of the United States are. So if he decides someday to bring down the hammer, it could be quite akin to his decision about sending National Guard troops into Washington, D.C. I need to change the subject. I need to be seen as strong, because this just happened and this is distracting people from my domination of the news cycle. So it could be that. It could be the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, his closest associate in the region, mm-hmm. finally making a convincing argument. Mr. President, you have just got to do this. My subjects, 100% of my subjects think that genocide is going on in the Gaza Strip. This is, this is undermining my own ability to reach my 2030 vision for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There are factors here that could bring about a change, but again, it's not rooted in a coherent sense of what American interests and what American strategy is. So it's difficult to predict and say, oh yeah, this is certainly something President Trump is going to do.
Well, I think that it's true that unlike in the case of Ukraine, which we were just discussing, President Trump actually does have the potential to have real influence over the outcome of what happens in Gaza and Israel. That article you read from Joe makes it sound like these terrible problems are going to occur. Like they're facing starvation. Let's be clear. People have already died.
Right.
Lots of people have already died of starvation. This has been going on for quite some time. This is current. It's the federal government. The U.S. federal government has the ability to do something about it. Not the mayor of whatever village you might live in, or town or city. Like, I know there's a lot of people are really upset about what they see happening in Israel, what the Netanyahu government is doing. But the town you live in doesn't have any say in what goes on there. And I've seen a lot of one of the most public efforts of sort of local democratic activism across this country over the past year or so has been people getting their county legislature or their city council to adopt resolutions that sort of excoriate Israel, the Israeli government, for what it's been doing. Is the Israeli government policy worth excoriating? Yes. Is taking up the time of your local government to do that worthwhile? Does it have any actual impact on the situation over there? The answer is no. The impact it has is it causes people like me, who actually want to be involved in solving local problems that the local government has the authority and the resources to impact. It keeps me away from those meetings because I don't want to fight those people. It keeps all kinds of people from getting involved in solving local problems. So I just want to encourage. Everyone should be concerned about the terrible things that are happening in Gaza and elsewhere around the world where there are famine as well. The right place for those protests is the federal government, which has the tools, the infrastructure to actually impact those problems.
We'll pause there. We'll come back and finish up the show. We welcome your letters. Last call, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll return right after this. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion. You all rock, by the way. We have great panelists today talking about all this stuff and such knowledge and thoughts. It's really wonderful to be in the room watching it all, and hopefully you're enjoying listening to it as much as you can enjoy the severity of what we're discussing. I want to just try to wrap up here and get to maybe one or two stories in our remaining moments and things that I thought were interesting. The one story, and again, I mentioned this at the beginning of our show when we were talking about the cities and how they are faring, our nation's cities. And I mentioned Philadelphia. And there's a story in the Washington Post. This is a local story out of Philadelphia, but really a national story because it affects so many. And the reason that I chose this story is because of the term death spiral. Philadelphia Transit across Philadelphia and its suburbs. Commuters are bracing for a dramatic reduction in public transit after state lawmakers were unable to agree on funding. So unable to agree on figuring out how to get people from one place inside or outside the city to another place inside or outside of the city. And it has been said that this is a death spiral for Philadelphia Transit, better known as SEPTA, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Association, or
they
authority.
Surely
authority.
Could have found a better acronym, yeah. Or something sounds SEPTA. Less like septic.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That's
or
exactly
or
it.
Septum. But yes, you're right.
deviated.
And like so many of the trains coming out of SEPTA. So this is a huge thing. The other part, SEPTA officials have called it a death spiral. The changes to one of the nation's largest mass transit agencies are expected to hit the poor, elderly, and daily commuters the hardest. Many will have to start their commutes earlier and arrive home later. But since the pandemic slashed ridership for big city transit systems, not just SEPTA, but big city transit systems across this country, has transit experts raising questions about the sustainability of public transportation that millions of Americans rely on every day. They have warned of fiscal cliffs, quote unquote, in which transit systems start cutting services, potentially reducing ridership in ways that necessitates even deeper service cuts. Transit agencies in Chicago, Dallas, Portland, and San Francisco all face similar challenges to what SEPTA is facing in the city of Brotherly Love. SEPTA serves about 800,000 riders daily, will curtail service on all bus and rail lines by 20%, as well as eliminate 32 bus routes over the next 24 hours. They're in the process of doing that right now. The changes are expected to make buses and trains slower and more crowded, as well as present new complications for 55,000 Philadelphia students who start school this week.
Yeah, we're seeing this all over the country. CDTA, I think, just is pulling back some stuff, too, locally. I mean, we have the Trump administration cutting funding for all kinds of things, including transportation. Then they'll complain that there are too many people on public assistance, which will happen because these people can't get to their jobs anymore, right? So they're just creating this constant drone of problems. And public transportation does have its challenges, but it's absolutely needed. And we, you know, people can't afford Uber to get to work. As the guy said in the article, when I make $12 an hour and Uber costs me 20, right? So something needs to be done. And the Republicans in Pennsylvania need to get a grip because they're the ones who put the kibosh on the funding.
Well, this has been building up for a couple years. I mean, public transportation at every level was severely impacted by the pandemic. And even it took a long time to come out of the pandemic, years trying to hire back drivers for buses. I mean, there were serious gaps there for a long time. And I think a lot of systems still haven't really recovered from that. I mean, we fortunately have a little bit of a good news story in Ulster County, where Fred and I live. The Ulster County Area Transit, or UCAT, as a catchier acronym.
UCAT.
Yeah. I think it was last year, they removed the fees. So it's free to ride the buses in Ulster County now. And of course, they've seen ridership go up and they've had more on-time service and it seems to be working pretty well. Of course, this is a much smaller system than we see in the big cities. I mean, I lived in New York City for a while. I got rid of my car before I moved there and I relied entirely on the public transportation in the city to get to work, to get to where I was going. And it's one of the things that makes cities really livable. And that's what draws people to urban areas and helps make them healthy is the ability to get around easily. It's I think that Death Spiral is an apt. I mean, you can't just cut some services and expect that people will be able to use the little remainder. You're driving everyone except the truly desperate away from those services, and then the truly desperate are going to suffer the consequences of much longer rides because, you know, the transfer that they needed is, you know, they have to wait an hour instead of half an hour. It's going to be the poor who bear the biggest burden of this.
You even look at the problems that they're having in Boston with the antiquated system and dealing with the T is just tremendous. Jim?
You know, public transportation, particularly in our big cities, for it to work, it has to be a function of federal, state, and local cooperation, and it really has to work together, you know, with money, of course. Money makes it all work, and it's got to be some balance between sustaining the system but also making it affordable for the people who actually use the system. Long-term infrastructure projects, these are often the things that are kicked down the road and not dealt with until it becomes, I think Boston is an example of that. That now it's, you know, it's catching up to them. Even what we were talking about before, you know, in New York City, people are, aside from whatever the statistics might say, people are very concerned about security and, yes, and crime on the subways. And so you have different levels of government in the crazy patchwork system that we have here in the United States. It really comes to bear with regard to public transportation. And if that starts to fall apart, what you see in Philadelphia is what happens.
And Hochul, I mean, rightly so.
20 seconds. Go
this
ahead.
Was a good use of the National Guard. She put the National Guard in the subway system for a while, not with guns, but to just temper the violence, just to stop crime. And it did have an effect.
Libby, Fred, Jim, Malia, you're all wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Have
pleasure,
a beautiful
Joe.
Day. We'll be back right after this.